Well, good morning, everyone. Hey, it's a great morning. I'm so grateful that you're here. If you're one of our members, we're glad you're here. Some of you may still be traveling on spring break, so you're watching online, or for other reasons you're online. We want to welcome you also. And if you're a guest, whether it's your first time or you've been here a few times, we're so glad that you're here. I've met a few first-time guests this morning, and others of you may have met them as well. So please be on the lookout for people that you don't know and make sure and greet them and make them feel welcome. I also want to thank those who have led us so far today in worship, not only to staff members, Jeff and Andrew and to Jim, but also to Judy and Jim Markham and to Ro Diaz. I want to thank Gerald and Gail Turner for helping orchestrate the tray passing that we started today. Thank you for participating in that. We think that a slow on-ramp to all of our trays returning will be a blessing for this church overall. We know it's some new things to get used to, but we're excited to see your names, and we think those friendship registries will really help us show the kind of hospitality that we want to show as we welcome each other each Sunday into this space. Before I start the sermon, I want to introduce you also to someone, a new member of the family of God. So Sam Unsworth, who some of you may remember we have prayed for in months past because he had a heart transplant, was baptized Friday by Farland up here. And so Sam and his wife Lauren and her son Colton Leonard are here today. And wherever you are, would you stand so that we can welcome you? Thank you. We're glad you're here. Thank you very much and congratulations. Welcome to the family of God. We're glad you're here with us this morning at Preston Road. We've been in this series called Who is This Man? And we're looking at the identity and message of the Son of God, of Jesus, not just so we can have information, but we want to know why it matters. Why does it matter that Jesus had all these titles? And what do they mean when we use them? And so the first week we talked about the Messiah, and our entry story to that was a prison cell in modern-day Jordan where a man who had devoted his time and his reputation to speaking up for Jesus now found himself wondering, are you really the one to come, or should we expect someone else? Then last week we talked about Jesus the teacher, and we found our way into that title of Jesus by a secretive midnight conversation between a teacher of the Jews and Jesus, where the man calls Jesus rabbi and teacher, and Jesus says, well, you're a teacher, why don't you know this stuff? And so we looked at Jesus the teacher and what it means if we call him rabbi, if we call him teacher. So this week, we're going to talk about Jesus, the Son of God. So Jim read for us a passage where John, the writer, says, you got to believe in the Son of God. And if you don't have the Son of God, you don't have life. What does it mean that Jesus is the Son of God? To get there, we're going to find ourselves on a mountainside outside the city of Jerusalem. It's a Friday afternoon, and the skies are quite darker than usual. And on the hillside, there are three men being publicly executed by the Roman Empire. Now, they had other ways of executing people, but this was an especially public and an especially humiliating way to execute someone they viewed as a threat to their power and authority. And it was a way to say, don't end up like those you see, because we'll do this to you also. So we look around, we see three men on crosses being executed. Most of the attention is focused on the one in the middle. It's not positive attention, though. People don't seem to be sad for this. They're insulting this man. And at one point, this man yells something out, and then it appears that he finally dies. But then, stranger things begin to happen. There's an earthquake right at that moment. And off in the distance, the tombs open up, and the dead come out of their tombs and start running into the city of Jerusalem, which obviously is going to scare everyone around. But at that moment, there's a centurion, a Roman guard, at the base of the cross. And he watches that man die, and he looks around, and he sees everything else that's happening, and this is what he says. He says, "Truly, surely, he was the Son of God." Now, other people had been saying that during the execution, but they were saying it mockingly. "Oh, he's the Son of God. Let him save himself. Oh, this man said he's the Son of God. Let God save him now." But this Roman guard says it, and he means it. He's convicted. But what does he mean by that? Why did these series of events cause him to say that this man is the Son of God? Why is that his reaction? And what's he mean by that? Is he all of a sudden doing like Trinitarian theology? You know, this is the second person of the Trinity, life from life, God from God. Is he doing that? What is he affirming when he says this man was the Son of God? So I want to talk about what it means for people to call Jesus the Son of God. And to do that, we need to take a trip back to Genesis and see in Scripture what it meant to use the phrase Son of God. So I want to talk about Son of God first in Scripture, and then talk about what it means for Jesus to own that title. So the Jewish people would have meant one thing by it, and then in a minute we'll talk about what the Romans, what did that centurion mean by that? Back in Genesis chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, this is right before the flood. "When human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them." This is a strange passage. We're not going to try to explain it all. There's a dozen theories for what this means. All I want you to see here is that here's a time when the phrase sons of God is used, and it's not about one divine being. It's not even about anybody good. Something strange is happening here. Something about this is so upsetting that it's part of the reason that God floods the earth. This is not good that this is happening. Again, I don't know exactly what it is. We could talk. I don't think we'd get anywhere. But the bottom line is, this phrase, sons of God, gets used, and it's not about the one person who's the second person of the Trinity. Then we get into the books of history, in the book of 2 Samuel, and we read a passage that begins to sound a little more like what we would expect. 2 Samuel chapter 7, beginning in verse 12. "When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son." Now, just a second. You might be thinking, oh, this is predicting Jesus. Well, keep going. "When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands." Okay, so this is probably not about Jesus. When he does wrong, I don't think so. "But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." Okay, so we're talking about one of David's offspring who will be the king. And if that's not clear from that passage, look at Psalm 2:7. "He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father.'" So in the Old Testament mindset, Son of God would have meant King of Israel. That's what they meant when they said that. Son of God is the King of Israel. We'll see that come back later. Now, what about the centurion? He's not steeped in, you know, Jewish thought, Hebrew scriptures. But the phrase Son of God also was in use in the Roman Empire. And after the death of Julius Caesar, people began to believe he was divine, and so his children would have been called Son of the Divine. So Augustus, we even have found coins, archaeologists have found them. You can see a photo of this, where Augustus Caesar, basically Son of the Divine. So it wasn't that they thought Augustus was divine, but that his father was, and that had a special status for him, and that kept going so that Tiberius Caesar, who is the ruler of the Roman Empire during most of the ministry of Jesus, would have been called Son of God. So for the Romans, Son of God meant Caesar. Now, you can imagine that the Romans might have perked up if someone's walking around, and even if he's not claiming it himself, if others are claiming about him that he's the Son of God. The Romans didn't care about the theological squabbles that the Jews had. You want to call someone your Messiah or don't? We don't care about that. But if you want to call someone the Son of God, we want to have a conversation with you. Because this is a threat. Is this person claiming to be Caesar? Because that's not okay. Now, this was sort of a threat to Rome. When we talk about Jesus as Lord in a few weeks, that's the big threat. But already, their ears would have perked up. And so, the centurion at the cross, I don't think, has determined that Jesus is co-equal with God in the second person of the Trinity. But what he's saying is, there's something different about him. And the things that the people have been saying about him that I didn't believe before, I think they're true. Because this kind of phenomenon would not have happened with a person dying if this being hadn't been divine. Something is different about this man who just died on the cross. So the centurion confesses, the oddest person of all in this story, the centurion confesses that Jesus is the Son of God. What do we mean when we claim Jesus is the Son of God? What does it mean? If Jesus is the Son of God, we need to know what that means and why that title is so dangerous, why it's so powerful. And the story I want to call our attention to is the day before what we just talked about on the hillside, the night before Jesus' death. We've had the Last Supper, we've had the prayers in Gethsemane, we've had the arrest, and now Jesus is hauled to a hasty trial where the Jewish leaders are trying to drum up false testimony against him, and they're not having any luck. So we find ourselves in Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 59, and we read this account of this conversation. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin, that's the Jewish ruling council, were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they didn't find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." "You have said so," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy." What on earth is going on to provoke this kind of reaction? Why is the high priest so mad at this? Notice the conversation when he says, "You tell us right now if you're the Son of God." Jesus essentially says, "You said it." He doesn't say, "Yes, you are correct." He said, "But you said so, not me. You said it." But then Jesus goes on to basically say, "Yes, I am," because he's quoting prophecy from the book of Daniel, where he's basically saying, "Yes, I am the one who has promised to come." But you can't be going around saying you're the Son of God. In fact, John tells us in his gospel that the Jewish leaders told Jesus, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." That's a capital offense to go around claiming that. Part of why it's so offensive is because if Jesus is the Son of God, then everything changes for these people. Because they've got to do something about that. They can't just hear that and shrug their shoulders. They either have to charge him with blasphemy or they have to accept his testimony. Scholar Darrell Box says that Jesus' statement left the audience with a choice. Either he had uttered words of outrageous blasphemy, or he was who he claimed to be, the very revelator of God, who is in equal union with God. Neutrality no longer was possible. That claim is bold. The claim is dangerous. It's a threat to the existing power structures, and now people have got a choice. And they can't just sit there and say, well, that's sure interesting. I'll think about that for a while. They have to follow him and accept his testimony, or they have to kill him. And we see what choice the people made. What about for us? If Jesus is the Son of God, what difference does that make for us? You may remember that the devil used that phrase against Jesus when he's tempting him. You know, if you're the Son of God, why don't you do all these things? So he had one set of beliefs, for if you're the Son of God, you should do these things. What about us? What's different for us if Jesus is the Son of God? There's one thing that's different for us that I think is very comforting. If Jesus is the Son of God, then first of all, we share in his sufferings and his glory. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8 that those who are led by the Spirit of God are the children of God. Notice that's about us. The Spirit you receive doesn't make you slaves so that you live in fear again. Rather, the Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship. And by him we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. Now, if we are children, then we are heirs, heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory. Notice all the child of God language there. That's kind of both about Jesus and about us. He's God's son. We are God's children. And the implication there is that if Jesus is God's son and we are co-heirs with him, then we should expect the same things, good and bad. Some of you might need a moment of conviction this morning to know that if Jesus, for instance, was called to take up his cross and die, then we too are called to take up our cross and make radical sacrifices. Some of you might need a moment of hope. See that Jesus, after his sufferings, was with the Father in glory, and to know that that same fate awaits those of us who are children of God. So the whole life cycle of Jesus is sort of mirrored in all of God's children. So we should expect sufferings. We can also expect glory. The second thing that's true if Jesus is the Son of God, and this was the threat in his day, it's the threat in our day, is that he is in charge. If that claim is true, then Jesus is in charge. Nathanael understands this in John 1 when he says to Jesus, Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. Notice again those two things going together. He doesn't say, you're the Son of God, and so I'm going to say nice things about you in my prayers. He understands that if Jesus is the Son of God, then he is the King of Israel. That's not just a spiritual title. That's a political title. You think, for instance, King Herod loved having someone going around saying that he was the King of Israel? I don't think so. Nathanael understands that if Jesus is the Son of God, then he is in charge. Or what about the people who watched Jesus calm the storm? What about their reaction? Matthew 14, they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. And then those who were in the boat worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. So this miraculous display of power where Jesus controls meteorology, and their response to that is, you are the Son of God. Again, Jesus as the Son of God is not just a theological or devotional claim. It packs a lot of power. And the final thing, if Jesus is the Son of God, just like those who heard him make that claim, we face a choice. You can't be neutral. Once you come to believe that this is an option, you can't just ponder it and say, well, this is interesting. I'll give it some thought for a while. The claim that Jesus is the Son of God makes a demand on us. It commands a response. And either it's scornful dismissiveness or it is an acceptance that causes us to change our lives. If we believe Jesus is the Son of God, we face a choice and we cannot be neutral. It changes everything. So I want to close by thinking about this. When someone is baptized, usually before that, according to Scripture and according to our practice, we ask them to confess Jesus as the Son of God. This is what happens. You've seen it happen here. Why do we do that and what does it mean? It's a typical question that you see asked. So yes, we're asking the person to affirm that Jesus is divine. We're asking them to affirm that Jesus is God. But we're also asking them to affirm that Jesus is in charge. Sometimes you'll hear people say, "Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? And are you willing to make him the Lord of your life?" That's what it means. If Jesus is the Son of God, it doesn't just change a belief in my head. It changes my worldview. So when we confess that Jesus is the Son of God, we're like that Roman centurion who watched a man die and watched the world change and decided there was something different about him. When we confess Jesus is the Son of God, we're like those disciples in the boat who survived a treacherous storm. And then because of the calming words of one who'd just been napping and seemed unbothered by the deadly weather, everything changed. And that caused them to say, "You are the Son of God." I want you to know something. If you have come to a conviction that Jesus is the Son of God, I don't want you to sit on that. I want you to do something about it. Every service, when we're finished, two of our elders are in the prayer room. If you have decided that Jesus is the Son of God, then I want you to go talk to one of those elders. I want you to talk to one of our ministers. I want you to be baptized, because if you believe Jesus is the Son of God, then neutrality isn't an option. I want you to act on that. So may we, as a church, may we as believers, may we as seekers, confess that Jesus is the Son of God, and may our lives be changed just as the lives in Jesus' day were changed. Let's stand and sing.